We're very fortunate indeed to have one of the leading poskim of the generation with us to answer some of our nitty-gritty questions concerning medical halacha, in which Rabbi Bleich is a leading authority. I'm sure many of you are familiar with his one of his latest books, Judaism and Healing, which deals with very modern topics in medical halacha. Rabbi Bleich is a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University, and also lectures at Yeshiva University's Medical School, the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, has been a fellow of the Hastings Center for Ethics, Society, and the Life Sciences, has published extensively. Many of you are probably familiar with his articles in Tradition and in Noyam. So without further ado, we'd like to get started with the session. The basic format consists of a list of written questions that people have submitted, and if we have time following that, we would ask for verbal questions from the audience. If there are any points to be clarified from those people who have written in the questions, please feel free to add your comments or additional questions as we discuss the questions.
Thank you very much. How shall we proceed? Would you like me to go through the questions in serial order?
I could read the questions so that the people who don't have a sheet.
Everybody has a copy, I presume?
I don't think
it would be good to read them anyhow for purposes of it.
All right. Okay, fine.
And then, feel free, as I said, no holds barred, to answer in the frankest manner. We're basically all physicians or rabbis, and I'm very anxious to hear the bottom line. The first group of questions concerns Shabbos, and the first question of which concerns educational meetings. Question is, may a doctor attend educational meetings on Shabbos? If he does, should he listen to those papers being presented by Jews over a microphone? May he supersede the dictum of the Shulchan Aruch against traveling on Friday afternoon if he would otherwise miss the Friday morning session? Can he actually violate an Isser of Shabbos if he has a Jewish patient suffering from a serious condition being discussed at the meeting? For example, if it were necessary to go through an automatic door on Shabbos to attend the meeting, could he do so?
All right. That question has several parts. First one caveat. I'll try to present the bottom line, if I can, but I think that it would be only fair to go through some of the steps and perhaps some of the sideways and byways that may lead to more than one bottom line. Also, please don't hesitate to interrupt if there's any point that doesn't seem clear or if there's anything that you think requires elaboration or elucidation. The first part of question number one, may a doctor attend educational meetings on Shabbos? In principle, there's nothing wrong. The problems arise with various things that may be incidental to the meeting on Shabbos. In particular, I presume that anybody going to a meeting on Shabbos will also be able to daven before he goes to the meeting on Shabbos. The question of papers being presented by Jews over a microphone, there is basically no difference whether the paper is delivered by a Jew or by a non-Jew. The question, basically, is whether it's permissible to listen to somebody else speaking over a microphone on Shabbos. I say there's no difference between a Jew and a non-Jew because I presume that the Jew is not reading it for your benefit and will continue reading even if you walk out the room. There's no question of Lifneiver or even of Messiah. The basic problem is whether it's permissible to listen to a microphone on Shabbos. Now, I make that point because of one consideration only. In addition to whatever malacha may be involved in use of a microphone on Shabbos, it is possible to overcome all of the malachas in the microphone. The transistorized microphone, for example, does not present any question of a deraisa, at least to the best of my knowledge, provided that the microphone is put on before Shabbos. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's permissible to use a transistor microphone on Shabbos. Going back, what is it, probably about 10 years, the famous Rav Lunterman South African controversy. There's somebody here from South Africa. Rav Lunterman, as a friend of Rocha, allegedly was not there a transistor microphone for South Africa. Whatever happened, I don't know. I have a copy. I have a letter from Rav Lunterman, which he says that he stated that the transistor microphone does present a problem with the deraisa. The derabonon is another matter entirely. Now, the derabonon is mashmiyaku. A microphone is considered by virtually everybody to be in the category of a musical instrument. A musical instrument doesn't mean something that makes melodious tones. Any voice amplification system, as distinct from a megaphone, is in the category of a clay shear, and hence the use of a microphone on Shabbos is definitely forbidden. Now, what does that have to do with somebody listening to a paper being read on a microphone? Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, in an article that was originally published in Sinai, of all places, but has been republished in a little Moshe Rav Kook publication that has a collection of articles by Reb Shlomo Zalman. Reb Shlomo Zalman, to the best of my knowledge, is the first person to make the point that the Iser of Mashmia Koil devolves not only upon the person who plays the instrument, but on the person who listens to the playing of an instrument as well. Now that's a chiddush. That's not simple by any means.
Is there a what?
Mashmiyakur, using a musical instrument. Reb Shlomo Zalman maintains that it's forbidden to listen to somebody playing an instrument on Shabbos, as well as the playing itself. In terms of practical applications of halacha outside the medical field, if somebody were to put on a radio or a television set on a Shabbos clock and listen to it on Shabbos, what technical issur is involved? According to Shlomo Zalman, there is the issur of mashmiya koel, and that applies to the person who listens as well as to the person who plays. Now, if that's true, then there would be a prohibition against listening to somebody speak or deliver a paper on a microphone. That by no means means that everybody agrees with Reb Shlomo Zalman that there is a prohibition against listening to the playing of musical instruments on Shabbos, but there are others who follow his position with regard to radio, television, etc., and it applies equally to the case of the microphone. So, as I said earlier, there's no difference whether the presenter of the paper is a Jew or a non-Jew. The prohibition is in terms of listening to somebody speak over a microphone on Shabbos, according to those who maintain that the Yisr of Mashmiya Koel applies to the listener as well as to the player on the instrument. Now, the other parts of the question, let's deal with the last one first. That seems to be the most serious one. If there's a Jewish patient suffering from a serious condition being discussed at the meeting, can he violate Shabbos to attend? The answer is, of course, and of course not. I don't think there's a contradiction. If you do have a patient who's suffering from a life-threatening disease, and the only way you can get crucial information is by listening to a paper, then certainly. But that's in the theoretical world. I think in the real world, you could get the same information some other way, if in no other way than by making a phone call to whoever is going to be reading. My impression is that in the usual course of events, you would be able to find whatever information is necessary for the treatment of your patient by a simple phone call. You may understand the procedure a lot better and may benefit from the discussion, etc., but it would be rather difficult to think of a situation in which it would be absolutely imperative for the treatment of your patient that you be in actual attendance during the reading of a paper. Of course, the theoretical information that you might acquire that way might be beneficial sometime down the road because you don't know what complications may arise in the next patient that presents itself with this disease or syndrome or what have you, but that's not in the category of a chelul l'choneinu. but it's not in the category of a danger that is here and present. So that, again, you know, in theory, if that's the only way to get the information, certainly, but I don't think that in the real world that's the only way to get the information that you will need for the treatment of your patient. The problem of traveling on Friday is bismaneno ono not really a serious problem. At least I don't think it's a serious problem, at least in most circumstances. Now, clearly, if you were going to take a horse and wagon out to the wilds of the desert someplace, there would be a problem. However, if you're going to be taking a train, or for that matter, even a plane, which has stops along the way, and the worst that can possibly happen is that you get out and check into the nearest hotel, or at worst, wait in the waiting room over Shabbos, the strictures against traveling on Erev Shabbos don't apply under those circumstances. You can travel from one side of the city to the next, to the other side of the city on Friday afternoon, because even if your horse becomes lame, nothing's going to happen. It won't be necessary to be Machal Shabbos from one side of the city to the next. And when you're traveling with the type of transportation that's available these days, I don't think that that is a serious problem. Certainly not if it's of significant value to you professionally and in the treatment of patients to be at a session on Friday morning. Now, of course, Chochem Ein HaBurisha, that doesn't mean that you take a plane that's going to arrive 10 minutes before Lichtenstein. I mean, that you have to be concerned about. But ordinarily, planes these days, I gather, travel with something like a half hour extra spare fuel. They presume that you can reach an emergency landing spot within half an hour. And if you've arranged to arrive within sufficient time before Shabbos, in terms of any emergency that might arise, the net result of the travel is highly unlikely to be a Chilul Shabbos. I don't see any real problem. Yeah.
Before you leave this question, I want to add another aspect to this educational meeting issue. Many educational meetings, in addition to requiring the person, the listener, to sit at the meeting and listen to the paper, may require some practical experience as well, such as anatomic dissections of new techniques, or use of new microscopes, or use of new techniques. These types of meetings are, under most circumstances, given only in such a manner that Shabbos is always included within the educational format. It's sometimes Friday and Shabbos, or sometimes Shabbos and Sunday, and that this type of course may require type of work which may be done on cadavers or on animal eyes or on limbs, but definitely requires the use of instruments and or tools for which there may be some questions. Can one attend such courses, and how does one conduct oneself when taking a course like that?
All right, specifically, the use of microscopes.
The scope of lights and microscopes and suture material and dissection instruments.
All right, the microscope, provided that you don't have to switch on a light. I presume that those are set up with the lights already on. At least I would hope so. If not, ask whoever used it before you not to turn it off. That's perfectly permissible. Don't ask them to turn it on. The microscope is not mux on Shabbos, even if it has an electric bulb attached. There's no reason why you cannot use a microscope, or for that matter, any other optic instrument, provided that you don't turn on the light yourself. Dissections, I would prefer not to give you a definitive answer now. I'll be glad to do some further investigation and respond sometime in the future. But I don't see any problem with any of the other instruments.
Is there any problem with Maris Ayin in any of this?
There's never a problem with Maris Ayin with regard to something that involves an activity which is absolutely mutter, even though somebody who's not informed may not know that it's mutter. For example, I suppose that many people are absolutely convinced that a medical instrument that has a light attached to it is somehow muktzeh on Shabbos. It isn't. That's a simple, elementary fact that people are not aware of, and there's no Maris Ayin, certainly no Maris Ayin. So please, from Lachta, what happens? There's no problem. Just jot down the other instruments.
Okay.
Are there any other points with regard to question number one which you'd like me to talk about? All right, shall
we
go to
the second? Thank you, Dr. Frankel. Next is a question about Shabbos concerning rounds, which many surgeons have a problem with. And the question is, can a doctor make routine morning rounds on hospitalized patients on Shabbos about whom he has not been called for any problem to make sure that they are all right? Is he allowed to drive to the hospital for this purpose? And if so, if he's taking call from home, for example, is he allowed to drive home?
Okay. I see four questions. It's listed as question number two, but those are clearly four separate parts. Let me take the next to the last first. Can a doctor make, well, all right, first part, routine rounds on hospitalized patients on Shabbos, is he allowed to drive to the hospital for this purpose? Then I presume the first part involved making rounds without driving and making rounds without being involved in any other malacha or otherwise forbidden activity on Shabbos. The answer to that is clearly yes. You can examine patients on Shabbos, and there's no reason why you cannot examine them in a hospital, provided that there is no other forbidden activity that's involved. I gather that the crux of the question then is, he allowed to drive to the hospital for that purpose? Now, that becomes a very complex problem. If you have a patient in the hospital on Friday, and you know that he requires your attention on Shabbos, it seems to me that you have an obligation to spend Shabbos in the hospital to examine the patient. Now, that some of that material you can find in, if you're familiar with the Minchas Yerushalayim Siddur, the Dworkin Siddur, it has a little kuntres for refuah by Rabbi Neuwirth with a number of notes appended to the back by Rav Pinchas Epstein, Zechariah Lavrocha, and there you'll find a discussion of exactly this question. It seems to me that it's clear that if you know that it's going to be necessary for you to drive to the hospital on Shabbos, that you have an obligation to spend Shabbos in the hospital or the vicinity. However, there certainly can be situations where you're called to the hospital on Shabbos and you did not know that an emergency would arise or that your presence would be required. Under those circumstances, if the matter is one of pikuach nefesh, or the patient is a chela sheyesh b'sakona, then it's absolutely clear that you can drive to the hospital for that purpose, provided that there is nobody in the hospital equally competent to render that service, and provided that the patient has not made a specific request for you. If either condition pertains, either, in your opinion, there is nobody on call or in the hospital equally competent, and B, the patient has not requested you specifically, then there is no reason for you to go on Shabbos, and hence you should not. So that the first part of that question again, I gather that the making of routine morning rounds in hospitalized patients can involve either patients who are in the category of Chayla Sheyesh B'Sakona and in the category of Chayla She'ein B'Sakona. When it's known in advance you're going to be making routine rounds, then you've got an obligation to stay in the hospital or close by. When the procedure does not involve traveling on Shabbos or any other malacha, then there's no objection to routine rounds, certainly. The question of being allowed to drive home is much more complex. I'll assume for the discussion now that the patient is Jewish. And if the patient is not Jewish, there may be a difference in terms of driving home. And I also will presume that you're not driving home alone, but that you have a non-Jew, either as a chauffeur or as a taxi driver, who's going to drive you home. The Hitiru Seifon Mishum Tchiloson applies only to Yisuri Drabonim, not to Dereises. While you can travel to the hospital to attend... Sure. There's a general principle with regard to pikuach nefesh as well as to a number of other categories, and that is that in order shaloi lahachshilon losed lova, in order not to discourage someone from responding to an emergency call in the future, Chazal permitted violation of rabbinic prohibitions on Shabbos. In order for a doctor not to hesitate because he's being called to a patient, if he can't go home to eat cholent, he's going to hesitate. He may go anyway, but in the future, if it's a gray area, it may not necessarily require his presence, or he may be able to excuse his not attending the patient when in reality he really should attend the patient, and if he doesn't go home afterwards, he's less likely to respond on a future occasion. Therefore, the drabonon prohibitions are suspended, so that it will be permissible under those circumstances for a non-Jewish chauffeur to drive him home. It would also be permissible for a taxi driver to take him home. Chitzah under those circumstances would not be permissible. It wouldn't be permitted to take money from Rishus HaYochin to Rishus HaRabin to pay the driver. If you work out some type of charge arrangement, that would be fine under those circumstances. So that if he is going for purposes of Pikuach Nefesh, then it is permissible for him to utilize the services of a non-Jewish driver in order to go home. However, if he accepts a fee for the call, he cannot use a non-Jewish driver to go home. Under those circumstances, the assumption is that he's not responding to an emergency situation. He's going to collect his fee, and he will do so in the future as well. Therefore, he doesn't need an added inducement or enticement in order to make him respond. But since you shouldn't be taking fees for treating patients on Shabbos anyway, that I presume won't apply. So that, you know, in principle, there's nothing wrong with allowing a non-Jewish driver or taxi driver to take you back from the hospital, provided that you've gone for purposes of pikuach nefesh. Under those circumstances, it's all right.
Can I add a few ancillary questions?
Sure.
That put this in perspective? Firstly, routine rounds may involve violating showers. For example, an ophthalmologist or a neurologist making rounds would typically turn on a light to look in the patient's eyes, and so forth.
I thought I carefully said, provided no malacha was involved.
Right, but that's why we're asking the question, because
now,
of things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and a neurologist, for example, who uses an instrument to examine eyes, the problem there is turning on the light. Under those circumstances, I presume you can get a non-Jewish nurse to turn on the light.
So you would ask him?
Yes, yes. I presume we're dealing with a chayla. Amir al-Akum is permissible for the chayla.
Well,
he would tell the non-Jewish nurse to turn on the light for you.
Well, the question is, see, we're talking about a chayla who's in the hospital, but in no, you have not been called. So, in other words, you don't know until you look in the patient's eye whether there's anything wrong. He's not complaining of anything, really. But nevertheless, he's been operated on recently or whatever, and you want to make routine rounds.
Okay, all right.
I think the question that we're all interested in is, we need a little better guideline of a cholish yesh bo sakana, a cholish
right.
Ein bo sakana.
Okay. Which is a question not on the list. All right. Basically, there are three categories of patients in every hospital. There are patients who are cholish yesh bo sakana, there are patients who are cholish ein bo sakana, and then there are people who aren't sick. They're in hospital for a variety of reasons, but they're not necessarily in the category of a chayla. A patient who has been admitted for elective cosmetic surgery is not a chayla by any stretch of the imagination. He may become a chayla after the surgery is performed, but when he's admitted, he's not a chayla, and you can't do a routine workup on that patient. Amir al-Akum will be also for that patient. You could, I know, if you're, you've been called in, or the intern is examining a patient doing a routine workup, taking a medical history, because tomorrow morning the plastic surgeon is going to go to work, and if this happens, it's not going to work on Sunday. Assume it's Yontif. And he's doing the routine medical exam on Yontif, and he wants to play around a little bit to see if he can tell how pupils dilate, and he wants to make sure there's no neurological problem. He would have no right to do anything of that sort on Shabbos or Yontif. If for any reason it is necessary to do a neurological examination, even just to be safe, that's the type of procedure that should, under those circumstances, be done after Shabbos or after Yom Tov. I'm assuming that when you're making rounds for patients who are sick, not for patients who aren't sick, but that's a gratuitous assumption on my part. And clearly, you have to know which bed you're approaching when you're making rounds on Shabbos and Yom Tov. If you know that you're examining a patient who is not in the category of a chayla at all, that means that absolutely nothing is permitted that would involve any malacha, or for that matter, even amir lakum. Amir lakum would not be permitted for a patient who is not sick. Now, I say that with some hesitation because I have heard rabbonim mufokim say that there's nobody in the hospital who isn't sick. It would make life a lot simpler, and I wish I could say that, but unfortunately, I've lived in the real world too long. I know it's not true.
That was the gist of the question. In other words, I had heard a similar, Rabbi Zalewski mentioned that to me once, that something in the Talmud about somebody who's sick from the mouth in is considered a...
Yes, that's in the I haven't tried to define what is a chayla sheyesh b'sakana yet. I mean, I presume we'll talk about that a little bit more later.
Okay, but in other words, the mere fact that a patient has been operated on and you, at this point, do not know whether there's anything wrong with him in terms of sakana does not permit you to go in and find out.
Post-surgical patient may very well be in the category of a chayla sheyesh b'sakana, particularly if he's had internal surgery, abdominal surgery, or what have you. yes, all eye surgery is considered pikuach nefesh and halacha. Now, a patient who's had that type of surgery is in the category of a chayla sheyesh b'sakana as long as, in your medical judgment, he's still a chayla. Now, again, there comes a point when a patient is just occupying a bed because it's a good idea. It doesn't necessarily mean that he's a chayla the entire time that he's in the hospital. But that's a medical determination, and you people are more competent to do that than I am. If you've done abdominal surgery or eye surgery, the patient is clearly a chayla until such time as you're convinced that everything internal has been taken care of. The fact that sutures are still in place doesn't necessarily mean that the patient's a chayla.
May I carry this over just a little bit, not necessarily seeing the patient in the hospital, but seeing the patient in one's office on Shabbos as an emergency, the information reaching the physician by one means or another that there is an emergency to be seen at the office.
Mm-hmm.
That brings up several problems that have faced me in the past. One, what is permissible to for the physician to bring with him to the office, if only a key, how should that key be, the key to the office door, how should that key be arranged? When he arrives at the office, as far as putting on lights, you said already that it's permissible to put on lights and instruments, but how about putting the lights on in the office, if that is necessary? Is there any differentiation in this regard, as far as a Jew or a Gentile patient? Those are some of the questions that have come up in regard to seeing patients as emergencies.
Clearly, the locus of the examination is irrelevant. You do the examination wherever it is A, most convenient, B, wherever it involves the least amount of chilul Shabbos. That's one general principle to bear in mind. If the patient can be examined in your home, then by all means let the patient come to the house. If you need instruments that are in the office, then presumably it makes very little difference whether you go to the office and bring the instruments home or whether you direct the patient to go to the office and meet the patient in the office. I'm presuming that we're dealing with a chayla sheyesh b'sakana, or at least a sofik pikuach nefesh, that the patient has described symptoms that may be the symptoms of a life-threatening illness or a life-threatening accident, which means that whatever is necessary under the circumstances is warranted. At that point, it becomes simply a matter of minimizing the Chilul Shabbos to the extent possible, so that while you need a key to get into the hospital, the key should be taken, but put either inside a shirt or under a hat, Shalei Kederach Yitzua, not in the pocket, if you can remember to do it that way. In the office, unless you need the electric light for purposes of the examination, the light should not be turned on. It may be you may require light to conduct the examination properly, and in those circumstances, by all means. But if it's 12 noon and you've got a picture window in the office, you may be able to see whatever you have to see without an electric light being turned on. Beyond that, whatever is permissible in the hospital is permissible in the office or in the patient's home. The place that the examination is conducted is totally irrelevant to the question of what's permissible and what is not permissible.
Right. Except in the office.
It's more convenient. You've got instruments.
Right. And you wouldn't have other people around to turn on lights and things of that sort for you.
Yes.
It would be more difficult to carry out the examination in the office, although it may be more efficient to do it in the office rather than in the hospital in certain situations.
By that you mean that someplace else there may be non-Jews who can perform these various acts. Well, again, whenever you're dealing with a situation where delay can even remotely be significant, one does not employ the services of a non-Jew if it means any delay. So that by no means tell a patient to go to the hospital if that's an extra half-hour drive simply because you have a non-Jewish nurse in the hospital if you think that delay can make any difference. By the same token, if it's really serious, you may want the patient in the hospital anyway, in which case it would probably be a good idea to send the patient to the hospital instead of first to the office and then from the office to the hospital. That depends upon the circumstances of the situation. If you're dealing with an accident that may require sutures, for example, and you can do them just as easily in the hospital and the office as in the hospital, but in the office there's nobody to put on the light for you, etc., then under those circumstances you'd be perfectly justified in doing it in the office, since the delay might further endanger the patient. Dealing with an accident victim, something of that sort, where a time may be a very significant factor, and when you're unlikely to need the services of a hospital and support personnel, then by all means do it in the office or wherever else is convenient, even though it means doing everything on Shabbos by yourself rather than using a non-Jew. You never delay in order to use the services of a non-Jew when the delay can even remotely jeopardize the patient.
When you're saying jeopardize the patient, in Washington, let's say Jack's practice, where he's an ophthalmologist, what constitutes pikuach nefesh?
Is threat to eyesight equivalent to pikuach nefesh?
Well, threat to the eye is distinct to threat to eyesight, but those two are virtually synonymous. What would be a threat to eyesight is, in terms of halacha, threat to the eye, even though medically you may not be concerned with the eye. Again, there, going back to the question was asked before, in terms of a definition of pikuach nefesh, and basically the two definitions. A, whatever is standard medical definition, whatever medically speaking constitutes a danger, and B, whatever Chazal defined as a danger. What they defined as a danger is at least in the category of sofik pikuach nefesh. Now, Chazal stated that any injury or trauma to the eye is pikuach nefesh, whatever the reason may be. That means that it's at least sofik pikuach nefesh. You as a physician may not be terribly concerned about the threat to the life. Your concern is threat to the eyesight. This eyesight may not be pikuach nefesh, but if you have, I presume that these emergencies would involve accidents of some kind or another, that a patient's got glass in his eye, or what have you. That in halacha would constitute sofik pikuach nefesh, as a threat to the eye itself. Even though you're not concerned with the life of the patient, you just want to save the patient's sight, if possible. Nevertheless, in terms of halacha, you would treat it as sofik pikuach nefesh, which means that if you see any reason to do the procedure quickly in the office, by all means, do it in the office and don't send the patient to the hospital, if that will be any quicker. Yeah. Have I made it clear or not?
And if emergency surgery is necessary, if there is a Gentile doctor who could also perform that surgery by someone calling him on the telephone, what would be the best way to do that? Should the if the Jewish doctor is seeing the patient, feels that this isn't emergency surgery necessary, should he follow through or should he call on someone else to do the surgery?
Again, you have a patient...
Requires emergency surgery on Shabbos.
And in your opinion, it's not life-threatening? Or it is
should be done right away.
It should be done right away. And there's some danger to the eye.
Yes.
Yes. Now, the question, should you call in a non-Jewish physician? Okay. The answer is yes, under the following two circumstances. A, you think that the non-Jewish ophthalmologist is at least as competent as you. If you do not think that he is at least as competent as you, by no means call him in. B, if the patient has more confidence in you than in the non-Jewish ophthalmologist and requests you to do the surgery, you may do so even if you believe that the non-Jewish physician is equally competent.
What
does it matter if the patient is Jewish or not Jewish?
All right, so far we've been talking about Jewish patients. The $64 question that everybody's been approaching from different angles is whether all of this is permissible for a non-Jewish patient as well. All right, let me try to spell it out in some detail, and we'll see whatever conclusions emerge. Insofar as a Moloche D'Oraisa is concerned, a Moloche D'Oraisa on behalf of a non-Jewish patient is not permissible for purposes of saving the life of the non-Jewish patient. It may be permissible for saving the lives of Jews. If it is permissible, it's permissible because of pikuach nefesh, not the pikuach nefesh of this patient, but either the general fear that not treating the patient may have untoward effect for Jews in general, or B, that if you don't treat this patient, then other physicians will not treat Jewish patients, and hence jeopardize the lives of Jewish patients. Now, I don't think that the second consideration is really germane in the 1980s in the United States. The first may or may not be, and here I'll give it to you as it is. Virtually all contemporary prominent poskim permit treatment of a non-Jewish patient on Shabbos. The oldest source is a tshuva in the Chasam Sofer. Basically, it's a Ramo. Only the Ramo happens to be talking about putting out fires on Shabbos. If you lived in a small town in the ghetto and a fire started, even though it mightn't jeopardize Jewish lives, but if you don't put out the fire, you may end up with a pogrom because the fire will spread to the non-Jewish quarter and they will blame the Jews for not having put out their own fire, and hence Jewish lives are at stake. Under those circumstances, the Ramah permitted putting out a fire on Shabbos, even though there isn't the remotest pikuach nefesh to any Jew, or for that matter, even if there's no pikuach nefesh to a non-Jew, because basically the matir, the reason that makes it permissible, is that if you don't do it, Jewish lives will be jeopardized not by the fire, but by the non-Jewish reaction to your not having put out the fire on Shabbos. That's basically the consideration advanced by the Chasam Sofer in two different Yudas. Once in Yerdeya, I think it's Reish Tzadik Dal or Reish Tzadik Hei, and the second is in what's called the Likutim, it's the sixth volume. The first Tshuva deals with a midwife. It seems that it was shortly after the civil authorities required midwives to be licensed, or at least they require the attendance of a licensed midwife at every birth. And it turned out that in one community, the only licensed midwife was Jewish, and she wanted to know whether she could attend births on Shabbos. The only real forbidden activity involved was the travel, because as the Chasam Sofer pointed out in the Tshuva, there were enough other midwives around. They were perfectly happy to do everything that was necessary. You just had to have somebody physically present. And he was matirit under circumstances that would involve pikuach nefesh to Jews if they would refuse to attend. And that's the same thing is repeated in the second Tshuva, which deals with a doctor making rounds. And the question was whether he can use a horse and wagon in order to travel to his non-Jewish patients. And basically, the Chasam Sofer was matir. But he was matir only under certain very broad conditions, but it wasn't a blanket heter by any means. He said, for example, that if he has two patients to attend, one in the tchum and one out of the tchum, he should go to the one in the tchum and say he can't dance in two weddings at once. He can't visit two patients, and he should select the one that involves the least amount of chilul Shabbos. By the same token, if there were two patients, one Jewish and one non-Jewish, he would say go to the Jewish patient, even if he doesn't need your services that badly, and don't go to the non-Jewish one, and no one will be able to fault you for not having gone, because after all, you were out on call. You were attending another patient. Now, what I'm trying to give you is the flavor rather than the substance. The flavor is, sure, if there is pikuach nefesh involved, namely, if not attending the patient will mean that this will reflect negatively upon the Jewish community, and there will then be a threat of pogrom, then by all means, says the Chassam Sofer. But if you have any excuse whatsoever, any excuse that is acceptable, then you have no business going in the first place, because there won't be pikuach nefesh. Now, the Chassam Sofer's position is accepted by just about every contemporary Pesach who is written on the subject, including there's a tshuva of the Kloisenberger that's published in one of the volumes of Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Woldenberg's own tshuva, and an article that was written by Rav Runtman Zichron Livracha that appeared in Kol Torah about 13, 14 years ago. There was a newspaper report in Eretz Yisrael of somebody who had bled to death because the Jewish doctor refused to treat him on Shabbos because he was a non-Jew. It was blown up in the Israeli newspapers. There never was such an incident. Never happened. It was a complete and total fabrication. But this led to a number of publications, including this short article of Rav Unterman that appeared in the Israeli journal Kol Torah. Now, that's one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah, it's very interesting. If there's a Mishnah Berurah here, I'd show it to you. Mm-hmm. Huh? You have the third volume? What's very interesting is that the Mishnah Berurah in Shin Chof Ches speaks about doctors, and he speaks about them as being Yireim, Shleimim. He has some very nice things to say about them. And he says, but it's terrible. They treat non-Jews on Shabbos, and they don't listen to us when we tell them you're not allowed to. And it's absolutely also, his language is Ein Lohem al Milisma, which is rather surprising language. They have nobody to rely on. Nobody was ever matter this, and look what they're doing. He ignores the Chassam Sofer totally and completely. I'm certain that the Chofetz Chaim knew the Chassam Sofer, but he ignores him totally and completely and says, Ein Lohem al Mi Lisma. Now, what is interesting is that in here, there's a little note on the bottom. It's Shin, I'm sorry, it's not Shin Choches, it's Shin Lamed. It's in the siman dealing with a Yeledes, a woman in childbirth. I'll read it to you. Vada, the harofim afilu hayoyser ksherim, einam nisorim b'seklal, demasim b'chol Shabbos shenoysim kama parsois l'rapis evdi kechovim. They travel many miles on Shabbos. The kristin, they write prescriptions. The sechakin samemonim, the apothecaries on the side, they grind the prescriptions. Ba'atzmon, the ein lohem amashi yismechu, there's nobody to rely on. Even if you will say that a rabbinic prohibition is permissible, whether a rabbinic prohibition is permitted for the non-Jews' benefit, that's an entirely different matter. There are many places who maintain that every Yisr Drabon is permissible, Mishum Eva, that's the other side of Darkei Shalom, two sides of the same coin, unless they become angry, the Chachomim suspended the Rabbonans. He says, and then he puts in brackets, Va'af the Gamze Enobor. He is not willing to record as a psak halacha that an Isser Drabonon is absolutely, blanketly permissible. He cites the conflicting sources with regard to the Isser Drabonon, but he continues, Isser Deraisa Bevarai Osser Lekula Alma. According to everybody, Isser Deraisa is forbidden. Umechal Shabbos Gemurim Heim Bemezid. Hashem Yishmerenu. Now, that's in the text. It's Sif Koten Ches. Then there's a little note, an asterisk and a note on the bottom. It's not in the text. The note says as follows. he spoke about the Jewish physicians who travel kamet parsois lerapes oivdei klechovi. Who are these people? The Medinas India, Sha'ar Hayoim, who umos shom heim oivdei klechovim umazolos. Now, if we take this literally, we're talking about Reifim Hayeser Ksherim in India. There's many Jewish doctors, Shomri Mitzvah, who attend Indians in India. Very obviously, the Chofetz Chaim never wrote this. This was put in for the benefit of the censor, which I think is somewhat ironic. The Mishnah Berurah here is stating in effect that there is no reason to be Mechallel Shabbos for a non-Jew, but yet the publisher found it necessary to put in a disclaimer. Obviously, there was some fear about stating this publicly, even in such an esoteric work as the Mishnah Berurah, which may mean that there is something to be concerned about, and there may be reasons of Pikuach Nefesh. Now, I can't say anything beyond that. Clearly, even though the Mishnah Berurah says Ein Lohem Al Mishi Yismuchu, there is the Chasam Sofer and the Poskim of our generation of Yomatir. The Mishnah Berurah assers, as does Rabbi Batya Hadayev, the only contemporary Poskim, the only other one that I know besides the Mishnah Berurah who forbids a Molocha on behalf of a non-Jew on Shabbos, is the Yaskil Avdi of Rabbi Batya Hadayev. He died just a few years ago. He was a Svardi, a Makubal, and a Talmud of Rav Kook. And he wrote, I think it's 7 volumes of Tshuvas. There's a very short Tshuva in the Yaskel Avdi, which simply reiterates what's stated in the Mishnah Berurah. There's a clear-cut difference of opinion. Yesh lohem al milismach. There is grounds for being that. Yes?
When Rabbi Dworkin, the Lubavitcher of Shlita, was out here, we had a discussion with him. And he holds like the Mishnah Berurah, apparently. So that's what's prompted this question. And in addition, I think we have to there is a question coming up which really deals with this. And really, the question involves modern practice in America. The refusal of a doctor to do this would. I don't think you would worry about a physical pogrom against the Jews if this happened. There may be a lot of animosity, which from what you read, would even the Mishnah Berurah would even question whether an issa d'rabbanim could be violated on that basis. But certainly an issa d'oraisa, you would still wonder whether that alone was sufficient. In other words, doctors are known not to work 7 days a week, 24 hours a day in America. Everybody takes off, everybody is off, they get coverage and this and that. The question then becomes...
I can say this. I'm virtually convinced that if it will become public knowledge that you turn down calls from non-Jewish patients on Shabbos...
This would, I don't think you would worry about a physical pogrom against the Jews if this happened. There may be a lot of animosity, which from what you read, would even the Mishnah Berurah would even question whether an issa d'rabbanim could be violated on that basis. But certainly an issa d'oraisa, you would still wonder whether that alone was sufficient. In other words, doctors are known not to work 7 days a week, 24 hours a day in America. Everybody takes off, everybody is off, they get coverage and this and that. The question then becomes...
I can say this. I'm virtually convinced that if it will become public knowledge that you turn down calls from non-Jewish patients on Shabbos, no yarmulke will be admitted to the AMA and no yarmulke will be admitted to medical school. But I'm not at all certain that the ramifications would go beyond that. Now, by the same token, I can't tell you it's also. I can't tell you it's also if Rav Moshe is matir, if Van Buntemann was not there, if the Kleisenberger is not there. By the same token, I can't tell you it's osir if Rav Moshe is not there and all the others are not there. By the same token, I'm not prepared to tell you it's mutter either.
Rabbi Bach, aren't there some opinions that use other bases of a term like Mochashe, Tzrichel, and Gufa?
I'm aware of all of them. I'm aware of all of them, including the Tzitz Eliezer. The Tzitz Eliezer is, among other things, matter on the basis that if you're doing the Moloche because you're afraid of the danger, then it becomes Moloche and Tzrichel Gufa. The problem with that is that in order to use that argument, you first have to establish that there's a danger to Jews. Then you've got the Lomdish argument that becomes only Nisra Rabbanon. But at that point, what difference does it really make? Even if it would be a Derais, it would be Mutter. The Mishnah Berurah rejected that argument. Now, he was also aware of the fact that if you do it without
a... Would have to be an anxious akana for the Jews to be in Melacha Shein Tzrich L'Gufa. I mean, could there be other repercussions other than sakana, but still
the
to make it a
Eiv alone.
To make it a Melacha Shein Tzrich L'Gufa.
Not want to have your license suspended or what have you. Perhaps. The Mishnah Berurah didn't accept the argument. It's a very tenuous kind of argument. Now, going back to something I said before, one thing seems to me very clear, although I can't document it for you, but I think it's rather obvious. It seems to me that anyone who relies upon the matirim for purposes of treating a non-Jew on Shabbos can under no circumstances avail himself of a non-Jewish taxi driver to go back home. And the reason there is really simple. The heter, the matir, of the Hetiru Seifa Mishum Chiloson is so that you will respond to a call in the future and not neglect the patient whose life is in danger. If the heter to go to a non-Jew is because your life is in danger, together with the lives of everybody else, then there's no Hetiru Seifa Mishum Chiloson. A person who travels to a doctor on Shabbos cannot go home. The doctor who travels to the patient can go home. The patient is going to travel whenever it's necessary. You don't have to suspend Isurim on his behalf in order to prevent cases of Pikuach Nefesh in the future. It's the doctor who needs the inducement. But that's only when he's going for the benefit of the patient. When he's going for his own benefit, as I said earlier, because he wants to collect the fee, that's clear that he cannot avail himself of a non-Jew to return. And similarly, if he is returning because he's afraid of a local pogrom or what have you, or he's afraid of being suspended, having his license suspended or what have you, under those circumstances, he certainly cannot avail himself of a non-Jewish driver to go home. But here again, I think that basically what's necessary is a prophylactic measure to prevent the situation from arising in the first place. As somebody said before, nobody works 7 days a week. And if you have a practice which enables you to be covered during certain periods, then the solution isn't that hard. Most non-Jewish physicians would prefer to spend their Sundays on the golf course. It's simply a matter of covering for somebody on Sunday and let him cover for you on Shabbos. Under those circumstances, I just don't see the Eiv, I don't see the Pikuach Nefesh. If somebody is taking your calls for you on Shabbos, how can anybody fault you? And that's something to be announced publicly. I take Saturdays off, I've got my colleague who's covering for me, I cover for him on Sunday or what have you. Of course I'm available in an emergency. If he'll break a leg and he can't find somebody else, call me. But he's not going to break a leg, and he is going to take your calls, and there won't be any problems.
His remarks lead...
That's called prophylactic medicine.
They lead beautifully into the next question.
Yes. Can you recruit a Jewish associate who does not want to take off on Shabbos?
Let's take that first. Why in the world? Why? I don't see why. I get this question all the time from interns, residents. They'd like to be able to switch off with somebody else, that the other guy cover for them on Shabbos, so that they can go to shul and eat cholent, basically. And
I'm sorry, that's not the question. The question is, if a man in practice is thinking of taking an associate into the practice with him, and this associate is not religious, he's Jewish,
mm-hmm.
can this physician recruit the junior associate, knowing that the associate will be taking call on Shabbos.
What type of arrangement are we dealing with here? I gather...
I think Jack raised this question.
What type of arrangement is this? You're not hiring him as an assistant and paying him a salary.
Yes, he would be paid a salary. And eventually would
you're paying
partner.
Him a salary and you order him not to work on Shabbos, he insists? That doesn't make sense.
Well, eventually, the person would become a partner.
Sure. Eventually, when he becomes a partner,
yes.
At that point, it's his fees that he's worried about. Now, as long as he's working on salary and you tell him you have Shabbos off, he's not going to complain. He may complain about coming on Sunday instead of Shabbos, but he's not going to complain about the days that you're giving him off. When he becomes a partner and becomes concerned about fees, that becomes a different problem entirely. Now, even there, I assume you're dealing with a group practice where essentially everybody has his own patients and bills his own patients, but you cover for everybody else. Is that the other paradigm that we're talking about?
Well, actually, in a smaller arrangement, though, would be that all the patients would belong to, say, the two physicians in the practice.
You have just a two-doctor office.
Would do that.
And you're dealing with a situation in which he, in effect, is covering for you and Chavez. And you're hiring him, or you're taking him into the practice.
Initially.
I don't think that would be appropriate at all. It would be quite different if you're the junior member. And the senior member has been practicing on Shabbos all these years anyway. Under those circumstances, I don't think it's at all appropriate. If it's not in the category of Leif Neiver, it's certainly a category of Messiah Leif Neiver. I think it should be clearly understood that this is a Shomer Shabbos practice, whatever that may mean in the practice of medicine, and that we don't do routine examinations on Shabbos and things of that sort. I don't think it would be appropriate.
No, Jack has the option of hiring a non-Jew instead, but he feels that the Jew is a better physician.
I don't understand why there should be a question of a non-Jew versus a Jew.
Well, he has an option of two applicants for the position.
Right.
Are you saying that it's so bad the way...
Whichever is the better doctor.
Well, the Jew is the better doctor, but would run into this problem.
Why is there a problem? You will refuse to do this under those circumstances.
He has Kurian and Shabbos and then
he will refuse to become associated in the practice.
Possibly.
He would feel that the patients are not properly covered, let's say, or something.
Which then would mean, say, going outside of the practice to obtain coverage on Shabbos.
I still don't think it's appropriate. Not in that kind of situation. In a group practice where each one's responsible for his own patients primarily, although there's secondary coverage by the others, I don't see it in quite the same light. When you're dealing with a small medical firm, I don't think it's at all appropriate.
Yeah. Your answer, then, you dismiss the question out of hand, but is it totally inappropriate, then, to have someone else who's Jewish covering for Shabbos?
All right, let's go back to that. I do think it's inappropriate to have somebody else, another Jew, cover for you on Shabbos for two reasons. First of all, the observant physician knows what's mutter and what's osa, and will conduct himself accordingly. The non-observant physician doesn't know what's mutter and what's osa, and hence will not conduct himself properly. So, I mean, that's number one.
He doesn't know, is it embarrassing for him?
Yes, it is. Definitely. Okay. So it's at least the shaygig. In addition to everything else, just explain to me, what is the Rabbanim Shel Olam gain from this arrangement? You know, what's the bargain here? So you're having another Jew cover, did you're eating cholent, he won't eat cholent anyway? I mean, this seems to be rather minor.
He'll be on the golf course and driving to the shopping center.
I mean, so... or sleeping at home. You have no idea what he's going to do if he's not practicing on your behalf. Secondly, although this is hardly the significant point, but there's a beautiful Beis Halevi, I think it's in Parashat Shemos, again, it's not Halacha Pesukim. The Beis Halevi says that a mumer is nenash for pikuach nefesh as well. A person who is a flagrant Sabbath violator, for him, Pikuach Nefesh isn't Mutter on Shabbos. There's no category of Pikuach Nefesh for an Avarian. It's only for a Shomer Mitzvah, which means then, for an observant physician to treat a patient on Shabbos, where's Pikuach Nefesh? Now, despite all these things that I've been saying tonight, it's a mitzvah. I mean, you've got to do it. You're supposed to be doing it. To the extent that you can minimize what otherwise would be a Shabbos infraction, you're obligated to do so. But when it's not possible, then that's the mitzvah. That's what you're supposed to be doing. To the individual to whom Shabbos is a weekday, this is also part of the weekday activity, argues the Beis HaLevi. Which means that for you it's a mitzvah, for the other guy it's Naveira. So what do you want to do? What do you want the other guy to do it for? Better off doing it yourself. I don't think it's appropriate. I don't think it's appropriate to have another Jewish physician cover for you on Shabbos, unless. Well, this is again, in residencies, the situation may be somewhat different, and that's because you're under a different kind of pressure. You're under pressure to do things that don't benefit the patient. To do things that are routine, they benefit the administration, they prevent malpractice suits, and they're expected. And if you refuse to do it, you may find yourself out on your ear. Under those circumstances, if you don't think you can be oimid bin nesoya, then you might have a right to allow somebody else to cover for you. But I think everybody here is way beyond that stage. In private practice, I don't see the wisdom of having another Jew cover for you on Shabbos. A non-Jew by all means. I see no reason to have another Jew cover.
Part of the same question involves what precautions a Jewish doctor should take to avoid benefiting from work performed by members of his group on Shabbos. There are obviously financial considerations, which we probably don't want to dwell too much on, but for example, some of our doctors here are members of a large group known as Kaiser Permanente, which has clinics all over California, and as being group as being partners of the group may unwittingly being compensated partly by lab tests or something else done on Shabbos, or by coverage.
Explain a little bit more. What is this? You're paid salaries plus percentage of profits?
Yeah, actually, technically, you are a partner.
Yeah.
And the method of compensation is that there's a salary, and also there's an additional bonus based on profit.
Of the whole group?
Of the whole group.
The
profit of the entire group.
Right. I don't see any real problem. The problem is, seems to me, at least superficially, this is the first that I've heard of this particular arrangement, it seems to me not terribly much different from a shareholder in General Motors or what have you, a shareholder who cannot control the policies of the group. And since it's not identified as a Jewish corporation, and they continue their operations on Shabbos because they're interested in their share of the profits, it's a dated nafshik of it, I don't see any problem with that.
Yes. Can one physician be paid for doing something which is not considered halachically malacha, like giving a lecture for a group when he doesn't use a microphone or say...
Not unless he performs some service during the week as well, which could include even delivering the materials to be set up in advance or the preparation of the lecture. Now, that's, for example, it's no different from a chazan.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Chazonim daven the first night slichus, not in order to give people the free concert to see if they would like it and then buy the tickets. They daven the first night slichus, so they're paid b'havlod. They again get a lump sum for the 3 days of Yom Neroim plus the first night slichus, which is b'mei sachol. A balkeira, I presume, is paid for preparing during the week. Again, it has to involve some weekday activity as well. You can't accept the fee specifically for the Shabbos appearance.
But if there's some preparation involved, then...
Yes?
Would it be possible for not just for the benefit of those present, but even those who are going to hear the tape, to try and use as much English as possible? I think that people are missing...
I'm sorry. I thought I asked anybody to stop me if they use a term that's not... readily understood by everybody. I'll be glad. I'll try to remember to translate. And I do hope that the tape isn't going to be played publicly.
No.
Yes.
There's one other question relating to practice on Shabbos that may not... practice in general, which may not fit with Shabbos, but...
In other words, if the fellow listening to the tape needs the English translation, please think twice before you play it. Go ahead.
Which doors, if any, need mezuzahs in a doctor's office?
In a doctor's office?
If he's sharing it with non-Jews, let's say.
If you're joint tenants, none of them need.
Or if one's employed by somebody else.
If you're employed by somebody else, none need. If it's your office, they all need.
What if you're a group partner?
And the non-Jews in the group? We have a non-Jewish partner in a house that doesn't require mezuzahs.
How about examining rooms in general? Is that like a bathroom?
The examining room is not like a bathroom by any means. It's like a bedroom. And it's the same status as a bedroom.
But even though there's, you could find in the examining room throughout the course of the day, there would be
people extra, will be disrobed.
Not only disrobed. I mean, there would be really out in the open during certain examinations.
It still would require a mezuzah. So it's not a bathhouse.
Okay, maybe we should get. We already covered the next question. May a Jewish doctor violate an issue midiraisa to treat an akum on Shabbos?
Okay.
So I think there are no further questions about that. Although, well, I think we'll cover that. The next question concerns taking call on Shabbos. Can a physician carry a beeper on Shabbos? Can he use a telephone if he is not certain whether the call has anything to do with pikuach nefesh, or if he's gotten beeped, for mm-hmm. example, can he go and use the telephone to find out what happened when it may simply be an airline confirming a reservation or something like that? And is there any minimum number or percentage of Jewish patients in your practice that are required to use these things?
If we have somebody covering on Shabbos, then these aren't problems, are they? All right. Can you carry a beeper on Shabbos? Reb Moshe has been widely quoted as permitting the carrying of a beeper on Shabbos. His argument is as follows. There is a clear halacha that a soldier is permitted to wear a sword on Shabbos. It's an article of clothing. It's an adornment. Argues Reb Moshe, since nobody except doctors wears a beeper is the medical guard. Now, I stated that because it's clearly not true. Reb Moshe doesn't know anybody who carries a beeper except a doctor. And therefore, this is the answer that he gave in response to the question. It seems to me that today, certainly, maybe 10 years ago was different, although I don't know how many doctors wore beepers 10 years ago. But every time Dick and Harry walks around with a beeper today, it's certainly not an indication that the carrier is a doctor by any stretch of the imagination. I do not see a blanket heter for a beeper. But it seems to me that there's a very simple way out, and that is to make it into a Shabbos belt. It can be made into a Shabbos belt. It requires a little ingenuity. All that it really involves is getting a metal smith to attach a hook to... Oh, you made a tie-clip out of it?
No, I just wanted you to demonstrate. But you could just put a piece of elastic here and there and beat them in.
No, a piece of elastic won't work. It's got to be an integral part of the belt. That means that if the beeper were to be removed, the belt would fall down, which means that you've got to hook it onto each side. Now, this is a plastic one. If you use a metal one, I think it's a little bit easier. But I don't know. I'm sure there are ways of attaching things to plastic. You attach something on this side, you put something on that side, and you get somebody to put a little hook on the belt, and you put it in. It seems to me that that works. I have one member of my shul who fashioned himself a rather odd but ingenious looking tie clip out of a beeper, which he proceeds to wear on Shabbos. He never asked, he just did it. And if indeed it's a tie clip, every time I look at it, I can't make up my mind, does it look like a tie clip or doesn't it look like a tie clip? If you could make a tie clip out of the beeper, I think that would work just as well. But I think that the simplest way is to make a belt out of it. It can be done. It means making a belt and going to a metalsmith and telling him, find some way of integrating the beeper into the belt, and you've got a solution to that particular problem.
I don't understand why a piece of elastic, like you do with a key that has two holes on it, wouldn't. In other words, there would be a loop one above the other. If you were to remove the beeper, the two sides would not be connected, and therefore would not be a belt anymore.
I don't follow, but fine. If that's what happens, it's good. How do you do it?
Well, you just make a loop, two loops on a
piece of elastic that are not connected. One loop is slipped in above the other.
Oh, you mean not a belt? You mean you make a belt out of the beeper with elastic?
The belt becomes the beeper becomes the belt buckle, basically.
I understand. In other words, using an elastic belt, not a leather belt.
Yeah.
And then where will you wear carry this? Where will you wear it?
Around your tits or somewhere.
Oh, you have to be careful. You can't do it on the pants if you're wearing another belt.
No. Okay.
Yeah, it has to be over the shirt. You can't have more than one chagur or one belt per garment. So that you couldn't put it around your thigh or the hip or what have you. But if you do it over the shirt, then you've got a belt for your shirt. Fine, if it works.
There was one problem with that. We spoke to Reb Handel in Montreal. Yeah. And that is, he questioned the battery inside since it's removable and suggested that we solder the battery in. Which we did.
It's not necessary. Okay. Where does that take us to?
What about the telephone?
The use of the telephone.
You get a call now. Can you, in other words, at what point do you stop using the phone? Can you hang up if you find that it's not the good method?
Well, first of all, there is now the gramophone on the market that turns every phone call into a drabonon. Not that it makes terribly much difference, but it does make a difference. This was the Machon Technologie in Eretz Yisrael. Perfected one of these telephones. I gather they're rather inexpensive, and you can simply install the phone during the week as well as Shabbos. It turns every phone call. Well, it operates in some manner that by lifting the receiver, you do not automatically complete a circuit. The circuit is completed in an indirect way, so hence it can at worst be a drabonon, and you're not involved in derisis, which means that you could use it with a great deal more peace of mind than other types of phones. Now, in general, if you have a patient who is in the category of chole sheyesh bo sakana, and you have reason to think they may be calling you with regard to that patient, I don't see any objection to answering the phone on Shabbos. But that doesn't mean that this is the preferable method. I think that you ought to have an answering service, or somebody covering for you, or what have you. I mean, the way to avoid this particular problem, even if you have nobody covering for you on Shabbos, is either to have an answering service screening calls and calling you on another phone, or to have one of these devices that enables, one of these answering machines that enables you to hear the person speaking. It answers with a recorded message, sorry, Dr. So-and-so, cannot take your call right now. At the sound of the tone, please leave your name and a short message. And if the guy starts screaming, doctor, I'm dying, then obviously you pick up the phone, you continue talking. If he says, I lost my aspirin, you write me a new prescription, you know that you can wait till Mitzvah Shabbos. I think that's the way to deal with it. I'm not trying to beg the question, but basically, if you don't have any one of these things, or the machine goes on the blink on Shabbos or what have you, if you have a single patient who is a chole sheyesh bo sakana, I see no question whatsoever with regard to answering the phone in order to determine whether or not it's that patient or one of the patients in that category. But as soon as you hear that it's somebody complaining of a headache, which is not serious in your opinion, at that point you can't talk anymore. You just put
down. Can you hang up?
That's the problem. The problem is whether you can hang up or not. You can hang.
Can't say goodbye for sure.
Certainly not. You become very impolite suddenly. You can hang up only if there is a chole sheyesh bo sakana who may be trying to reach you. Now, that's only when you know that you have a chole sheyesh bo sakana. If you do not know that you have a chole sheyesh bo sakana, it becomes a matter of statistics. It depends what your practice is. If you're a dermatologist and you haven't had an emergency in the last 10 years, you have no business answering the telephone. By the same token, if you're a cardiologist on call and you've been getting a half a dozen coronaries a day, then I think even if you don't have any particular patient today because you shunted them to somebody else, I still think you can answer the telephone on Shabbos. But I think that depends very much upon the situation. And again, I think that the problem should be avoided by using at the very minimum one of those telephone answering machines that enables you to monitor the call.
Yes, isn't there a problem with the answering machine that we were talking about before with the microphone? Are you allowed to listen to one of these devices?
Yes, you're right. There is a problem. By all means, listen to it. I don't think if you have one of these telephone answering services, that is attached to your professional number, you know, the number that's being called by patients, the listening is certainly nothing beyond the Darabona. And I think that you can assume that the people calling are in the category of a chayla, and hence the rabbinic prohibitions are suspended. You can certainly listen to the incoming calls until you hear that it's the wrong number at any event. But you have every right to assume that somebody calling your office number is at least a chayla she'ein by sakon. He must be sick if he's calling the doctor. And I think you should listen to the monitor and then decide whether you're going to pick up the phone or not.
I'm not really specifically medical. Are you allowed to set one of those answering machines to pick up your calls on Shabbos and then listen to it after Shabbos? Things that were recorded on Shabbos.
On medical.
Just whatever messages should come in.
And you're talking not on the medical context?
Not on the medical.
Can you use one of those machines? One of those answering machines?
Have it turned on during Shabbos and listen to it after Shabbos. Not so that you can hear it, so that it's...
Who calls you on Shabbos?
Oh, I don't know. I don't have
the Jews one. Call? Oh, whoever. If the person anticipates the Jews are going to call them on Shabbos, mm-hmm. I don't think you should have such a machine in operation. Because then he's causing the Jew to talk into the machine on Shabbos. If, on the other hand, everybody who calls him is a non-Jew, I don't see any reason why he can't have this machine in operation.
That brings us back to the another part of that question, and that was... it may simply have been answered in the past. Do you have to have any minimum percentage or number of Jewish patients in your practice to justify answering the phone in the first place?
I don't think that it depends upon the number of patients in the practice. I do think, A, it depends upon whether there is a chelosh yesh b'sakon now who is your patient.
Oh, well, the implication of the question is you... Even you don't know who.
You don't know who's calling.
Right. You may not have any. You're maybe a general practitioner.
Again, what we're dealing with here is the question of chelul v'neinu, the patient here and now. If you have as much as a single patient who is a chelul sheyesh b'sakana, he's a patient who is afflicted with something that may be life-threatening, then every phone call becomes a sofik pikuach nefesh. And I think that you have a right to take the phone call in order to determine who is calling.
Okay, the general gist of this question was, right now, none of your patients are that sick, but you don't know they could be. In other words, you're just taking general call.
That's why I began by saying, A, if you have a patient whom you know is sick, or B, statistically, how many such calls have you had per day or per Shabbos? You may be the only frum doctor in town, and all your calls on Shabbos are pikuach nefesh. During the week, none of them are, because you're a dermatologist or whatever. But on Shabbos, your past experience may be that everybody who calls you on Shabbos is a chelosh yesh b'sakon. Under those circumstances, the statistical factor itself may be sufficient to make it a chelosh l'fanein.
Right, and can you combine those two? Can a cardiologist, who 99% of whose patients are non-Jewish, still say, since I often have acute emergencies, therefore my one Jewish patient may be calling me right now?
Let's try to narrow it a little bit. He is a cardiologist who has Jews with heart conditions?
His practice is 99%
non-Jewish. 99% non-Jewish, 1% Jewish. But the 1% are cardiac patients. A cardiac patient is a chelosh yesh b'sakon. Now, he may not be going to cardiac arrest today, but his condition is a chelosh yesh b'sakon, there's no question. A cardiac patient, by definition, is a patient suffering from a potentially fatal illness.
Okay. Yeah. When you go to lift up the phone, assuming it's permissible, should you do it with machinery?
Yes, if possible. I'm not quite sure what machinery is. I'm not quite sure what the unusual manner of lifting a phone is, unless you can knock it on the side so it flips up or something. I don't know if it'll lift with a pinky. If you could lift it with a pinky, fine. Otherwise, if you can knock it so that it flies up, that's the way to do it. If you can do it with machinery, by all means.
Okay, that brings us to the next question. And that is, we've been talking a lot about prohibitions that are midiraisa from the Torah or midirabanim. And one of the questions is there a general way either to tell, for somebody who is not that learned, to tell when something is midiraisa versus midirabanim, or as distinct from midirabanim, or alternatively, as Dr. Garden suggested, to change an act that would otherwise be midiraisa to one that is now only midirabanim, which would allow you to do a lot of things that you...
No, that's a compound question. Yeah. Essentially, you can change any procedure to a derabanan by doing it in some unusual way. It may not be possible to do it in an unusual way. For example, if you're a surgeon and you're not ambidextrous, I wouldn't advise him to operate with his left hand on Shabbos. By the same token, pressing a light switch with a left hand instead of a right hand isn't a shinui. There are things, writing, for example, if it's necessary, absolutely necessary to write a prescription, and there's no other way to do it. Since your handwriting is supposed to be illegible anyway, you write it with your left hand, if you're right-handed. In terms of the telephone, if you can knock it instead of lifting it, that'll turn it into a shinui. If you need an optical instrument and you can press it with your toe instead of with your finger without losing too much time, that would be a shinui. If you can do it with your tooth, a glove isn't a shinui. A glove is not a shinui. If you can do it, if you can take an orange stick and poke at it with your mouth, that is definitely a shinui. Again, if you can do this without losing time, when time may be crucial to the patient. But never waste time doing these things if time is at all important to the patient. Now, again, the basic question, I think, was a definition of what is a chelush yesh b'sakana. So I think I answered this in part before. A, whatever in your professional opinion is a sakana, is a sakana. B, any internal trauma or infection is a sakana. An infection or trauma to the eye is a sakana, even if... medically speaking, you do not think it's a sakana. It is a sakana by statute, by definition.
That brings us to the next.
A sakana of an aver is not a sakana, unless medically speaking it is. Now, it turns out that most situations that involve a danger to a limb will, at least in your medical opinion, involve danger to life. There are very few practical instances that will arise which will involve a danger to a limb but not danger to life. It can happen, granted. A danger to limb is not pikuach nefesh, unless it's medically defined as such.
Well, that brings us to one of the other parts of this question. There are many examples in the Shulchan Aruch, such as that, which state this or something or other is not a danger to life. Now, physicians very often can think of possible complications, which will then cause danger to life. And since we say there is a suffix, pikuach nefesh, a doubt about pikuach nefesh is still considered pikuach nefesh, or many doubts, one after the other, mm-hmm. How to what limit can you take this? For example, you said any internal infection, a sore throat could be strep throat. This, in a small percentage of cases, could result in rheumatic fever. Mm-hmm. And in a small percentage of cases, that can be life-threatening.
Two questions. It's in a typical Semitic way to answer a question with a question. I have two questions. My first question is, can you treat the sore throat prophylactically without compromising the health of the patient? Let's assume the worst, strep throat. What are you going to prescribe?
Let's say penicillin.
Penicillin, okay. Is there any, assuming that this patient doesn't have a history of allergy to penicillin, is there any serious reason why you cannot give him penicillin prophylactically instead of doing what? I'm not sure that examining the throat involves a malacha, but let's assume it does. Is there any serious reason why you can't give him penicillin prophylactically? If there is no serious reason why you can't do it, then give it without doing whatever else is involved.
Without examination?
Without the examination that involves a malacha. I presume the malacha here is turning on the light to look into the throat. You really need a light to do that? I don't know if this is a good example. You really need a light to do that? You can't do it in an open window with an orange stick?
It doesn't always work. I've tried.
How about transporting a light pole? A lamp? That won't work?
Some of them
To make it, in that case, essential might be the cell culture anyway.
Yes, I understand. That will confirm your educated guess by looking down the throat. You look down the throat, and you see what the white dots.
Isn't there the issue of whether you can wait a few hours before giving him something that was brown?
No, that's not really the issue. Because if he has an infection, then you shouldn't be waiting a few hours. If it were a question of waiting a few hours or doing the malacha, I tell you to do the malacha. If it's a question of giving him the penicillin prophylactically or doing the malacha, I would tell you to give him the penicillin prophylactically. You have no when you're dealing with a strep or any other infection of that nature, you have no business waiting a few hours, even if you're convinced nothing will happen. But an infection is dangerous, and halacha is dangerous. Even if medically you think a few hours isn't going to make any difference, you have no business waiting. Now, the other question that I had was, let me see if I can remember. Yes, what percentage of sore throats result in a rheumatic fever?
Dr. Welton.
3% of all sore throats are strep.
No. Strep throats, this is a double suffix. We don't know if it's strep, and we don't know if that would result in rheumatic fever. Dr. Garden, can you?
I would think it would be certainly less than 1%. I mean, it would probably be more like a 0.1% or a 0.001%.
Here. 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000.
I think it makes a difference whether it's 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000.
It does. That's the question.
Sure.
There is a limit on fish.
Sure.
I think we've opened that fish.
There's a difference between miyut and a miyutid miyut. Miyut is a minority of all instances, and a muted miyut is an infinitesimally small instance. Now, and halacha doesn't speak in numbers, so I cannot give you percentages. If there is a 1 in 1,000 chance that this patient will develop rheumatic fever or endocarditis, which is probably even worse, I will tell you to do whatever is necessary. If you tell me there's one chance in 10,000, I'm not sure. If you tell me it's 1 in 100,000, I'm virtually certain you shouldn't do anything. On 1 in 10,000, I don't know. I don't know if that's muted or muted or not. It's begging the question. My problem is I don't know if anybody knows. In this particular case, I think you should give penicillin without doing the examination if you can't do the examination with a table lamp or what have you. I think that should be the procedure in this case, since the penicillin is unlikely to do any harm. And under those circumstances, I don't think that the examination would be warranted. But you could just as easily give me another case where you have no prophylactic medication that is innocuous. And it's a matter of treating the patient with something that may be toxic. Only if there's a significant risk, you're going to give him the medicine that may be toxic. And if there's no reason to do it, you're not going to expose him to the risk. Under those circumstances, I'd have to have some statistics. If it's 1 in 1,000, by all means do it. 1 in 100,000, I don't think you have to do it. You know, something in between, I'm not sure.
This brings us to...
By the same token, in most of these cases, I doubt that you really know what the percentages are. Mm-hmm. When you don't know what the percentages are, treat.
There are examples...
Well, that in itself is a selfie before that.
Yeah. Yeah.
The selfie of the incidents is itself a selfie before that. There's no question of that.
Does that mean we're concluding, if somebody has a sore throat on Shabbos and for some reason even examining, you can't be sure that it's not strep. If you see a throat that's red, it may very well be strep. Are we concluding then that if you're obligated?
Oh, I think your example was bad. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but if somebody came to me with a sore throat and I knew darn well that I can't rely upon a visual examination, I might not want to give the patient penicillin if I could determine quickly by taking a culture, but if I were out in the wild someplace and didn't have a laboratory available, I think I'd give the patient penicillin.
But are you allowed to take that culture on Shabbos? So that you can give the patient treatment?
Tell me what's involved in taking the culture. You're going to swab the throat, and then what are you going to do? You're going to give it to the non-Jewish technician?
Yeah, I'll put it
fine. What's wrong? Now, if you have to run the machinery yourself, that may present the same problem as turning on the light. But in most cases, you're going to swab the throat and you're going to let the technician do the rest. And by all means, that's what you should be doing. Okay. I mean, that's what you would do during the week, I hope. During the week, you're not going to prescribe penicillin across the board. You will take the culture first. You're not going to rely on your visual examination. In this case, that's what you'd be doing at Shabbos anyway. That's why.
It's a bad example. We're prepared to wait for a day or two anyhow.
I don't think you should wait a day. During the week. I think you're waiting too long.
If this example is just a stand for other examples, then
yes.
I'll let it go. But if this is a specific example, to my understanding, it's been shown that the penicillin really is not being given for the strep throat itself. It's been found to heal the strep throat no faster than not giving an antibiotic for strep throat. It's really given to prevent these major complications with which you have time anyhow to start the penicillin, as long as it's given within a certain number of days of the beginning.
I see. All right. Yes, I realize that the penicillin doesn't help for the throat, but my impression was that even as far as the complications are concerned, delay can make a difference.
Yeah, now, it would seem that you'd have the longer delay, the higher the rising antibodies that you're trying to prevent with being. So you maybe want to treat right away and wait for the culture to come back and then discontinue the culture if the culture were negative.
My impression is that when you give whatever the dose of penicillin is for this, if you delay a couple of days, the penicillin is strong enough to knock out the infection that has already begun to invade the body. But that were you to have given the penicillin earlier, the penicillin would have worked to prevent the advent of the infection in the first place. Now, under those circumstances, certainly from the point of view of halacha, unless it's contraindicated on medical grounds, the delay is extremely unwise, despite the fact that you're reasonably confident that if you give it a day or two later, nothing untoward is going to happen. That's, in effect, you're allowing the patient to become infected because you're confident that you can kill the infection. Am I analyzing it correctly?
Not really.
Not really.
To allow someone to become infected? That's not a good way of putting it.
Well, we don't know how long. We just picked an example that would illustrate the point of how much of a suffer, how much of a doubt do you entertain? And I think we accomplished that point.
It's a problem for me in the shul, because the number of people who come up to me on any given Shabbos with a sore throat is that percentage I can tell you is very great.
And there may be a strep.
Does that mean that everybody comes up
to
me in shul saying I have a sore throat?
Let me give you the principle, and you tell me if it applies or not. The principle is that you do not allow a person to fall into a state in which he is a mesukan, in which his life is endangered, even if you have the therapy that will immediately bring him out of that state. In other words, as far as halach is concerned, you treat prophylactically on Shabbos rather than waiting for after Shabbos when you're not dealing prophylactically anymore, but you're curing a disease which has arisen in the course of Shabbos or what have you. Even though you're certain that you can cure this disease, you've got the magic that'll cure the disease after Shabbos. And I think that makes good sense medically to a layman anyway. Again, I know medically you're not terribly concerned. You don't care. Maybe I'm being a little bit overly glib, but you don't care if a patient contracts an infection as long as you know how to cure the infection. Medically speaking, that may make sense. But in halacha, you don't do that. And I don't think that as a layman, I don't think you do it medically either. So that, again, going back to your kids on Shabbos with the sore throat, you say 3% of all pediatric sore throats are strep?
No, 3% of strep infections will go on to...
Oh! See, there's a suffix here.
I see. That's not too
hard. There may be a change in that if there's a strep going around the community. Dealing with 3%...
3% strep.
Likely
I suspect that the number of serious strep infections is probably immune to the muted, at least the pediatric strep infections, unless there's something going around the community.
It's actual strep.
Right.
All the strep throat.
Yeah, sure. I would suspect that. But, look, you can check this in pediatric journals and probably find out what the instance is. If you were dealing with a strep throat, I think I would treat it prophylactically in any event, even during the week. I don't know if I've answered the question or we complicated it more.
Well, I just want to know practically in terms of a given patient in shul, uh-huh. child, that's a question that's coming up anyhow.
Right.
Given that the demon could look in the throat and now you think that it is strep, then
okay,
you're actually giving
you've,
that
you've had all these kids for how many Shavuosim in a row, and if we've treated them Shabbos or Sunday is irrelevant, how many of them have had strep?
Oh, you mean if they've been treated all the time? I mean, if they've
How many recently have you seen?
How many have you seen recently, and how many have had strep?
Recently, there was strep going
around. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
6 months ago, when there was no strep going around. Now, clearly, when the strep going around, whatever's necessary. That's certainly.
That's what I'm saying. Then I should actually make a point to get them medicine on Shabbos.
I think so.
They should.
I think a strep throat is clearly. That's
what I'm saying. Maybe I better.
You ought to keep a supply of penicillin available. Prophylactically. You should have it in shul. Yes. Yeah.